Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today's interview is with Charlotte Barrett and Sean Fallon, the filmmaking team behind A Bad Feeling, which cleaned up the awards at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2018. I know I say this all the time, but A Bad Feeling is just one of my all-time favorites. It's a beautifully written story, perfectly acted, wonderfully directed. The cinematography even kicks ass for something that takes place at a comic book convention. And Charlotte and Sean are also really nice people, a super cool married couple who writes together and directs together, and in this case, did a podcast together. But a few messages up front. First, Discover Indie Film is this podcast, and it's also a TV series that puts together a lot of the short films of the filmmakers who've done interviews for this podcast. It's on Amazon Prime Video. Just have to search for Discover Indie Film. It's 10 half-hour episodes, 26 short films. Please watch it, enjoy it, and if you want to be a righteous person, give it a good review. Okay, and one last piece of information I've got to give you is, during its festival run, the title of A Bad Feeling was The Phantom Menace. I just wanted it to be clear that when we talk about The Phantom Menace, we mean Charlotte and Sean's film, and not the one made by that other guy. But anyway, enough setup. Let's talk to Charlotte and Sean.
We did. We met our first day of film school, of actual production. And we were sitting next to each other at like the orientation for like how to use all the equipment. That's like, you know, 10 hours long. You remember?
They have to do it for insurance. They say at the beginning, you're not going to remember any of this. This is just for insurance reasons. We have to do this. We have to show you how everything works, but sorry. And yeah, so we were
right before you touch anything.
Yeah,
we have to
liability.
Do this for liability. And
this is your iTunes acceptance form.
That's exactly.
Yeah, but they make you actually read the user agreement.
Yes. And sit.
So it's like an 8 to 10 hour day because we both transferred into NYU.
And I was going to say, was that NYU? So it was NYU.
Yeah.
Was it their undergraduate program?
Yeah. Yes.
I got to tell you, a lot of good filmmakers come out of NYU.
Yeah, it's a great program, and we learned a lot and met a lot of great people and you know, met our partner.
Yeah, met each other. So
that
we
really,
like it.
Yeah, we really love NYU. But before that, I went. You know, I kind of grew up doing photography, and I really love movies, but I didn't. You know, I grew up in South Texas, and I just didn't think that was an option for me. And then I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, a small liberal arts school, and I took a film class. I took it just an intro to film, and it was film criticism, film theory. And I took it with my roommate, and I just really loved it. And I really just kind of intuitively understood it. And my roommate just had such a hard time you know, figuring out coverage and like why you would cut at a certain point. And it all came very easily to me and kind of effortlessly. And so I was like, oh, maybe this is what I should be doing. And this is, you know, cause it combines all of the art I love, you know, photography, theater, music, painting. I mean, it's such an accessible art. I decided that semester, my freshman fall semester, to transfer to NYU, and luckily I got in and met the kiddo sitting next to me. So what about you, Sean?
For me, I always wanted to make movies. Just you know, since I was born, you know, so I was like, I remember being 5 and wanting to make movies, but I didn't know what that meant. I knew, you know, so I wanted to be either an actor or a photographer because I knew a camera was involved. And I was obsessed with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so I wanted, you know, like I loved Arnold Schwarzenegger, obsessed. And when I was 10 years old, Terminator 2 came out. And that was just the greatest movie ever made. That was just...
That is actually a very good movie.
It's a fantastic movie, but like, you know...
I saw it in college.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It's amazing. Yeah, it is just a brilliant movie. And at the time, you know, the world had changed with Terminator 2. But I didn't understand, like, why is this movie better than The Running Man? why is it better than Commando? And for Christmas that year, my parents bought me, they released like the illustrated screenplay. And I saw it said written and directed by James Cameron. And I was like, what does that mean? Arnold, I thought Arnold made the movie.
Right, right. And so, you said that was at age 7?
10.
10, 10.
Yeah, 10. I saw, and I was like, what does that mean to write and direct? And so then just, you know, became interested, like, oh, this the director made the movie and the writer wrote the movie. And what does that mean? And who are these people? And like, oh, James Cameron makes really good movies and the director of Commando doesn't.
Not good.
Not as good.
They don't resonate as much with you.
Yeah, they do not. And so, yeah, that got me really interested. So I started then, you know, doing the, you know, video camera with friends and making little movies after school and then wanting to go to film school. But my grades out of high school were pretty bad because I was just watching movies. And so I just went away to a state school my freshman year knowing, like, okay, I need to build my grades up to go to a film school. So then I went to I built my grades up and was able to get into a state school in New York called SUNY Binghamton, which is like the best state school they have, but had a film program. It was, I think, the only state school at that time with a film program. I didn't realize, though, it was all avant-garde film, which is great. I really enjoy avant-garde, but it can be that one year, my sophomore year, I saw a lot of close-ups of babies being born intercut with, like, animals being murdered. And that is slaughter.
Made by other students. That was the bold choice.
And I mean, there are only so many like truly classic avant-garde movies, and so
there's only 100 years of movies.
Yeah, yeah, and avant-garde like just hasn't been a great focus. So the teachers don't really communicate. So you'd see the same like 3-hour avant-garde movie 3 times a week because 3 different teachers show it. So I got very burned out. So I built my grades up even more and was able to transfer to NYU my junior year.
That's impressive. I'm impressed with both of you that you got into NYU on a second effort or first effort, but you know, second collegiate effort.
Yeah. My parents were shocked.
So were mine. And I don't think they were very happy about it.
Because you were going so much further away?
Yes. Well, I'm from South Texas and, you know, and New York City is a bit of a scary place, for a young girl, according to my parents. So I had to do a lot of lobbying and a lot of talking.
And by the way, South Texas, are we talking like Houston suburb?
San Antonio.
San Antonio.
Yeah. San Antonio.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, it's a lovely town. But yeah, you know, both sides of my family in San Antonio.
You're like the only member of your family to not live in San Antonio going back 6 generations.
Yeah.
Which is saying something.
Yeah, it's
they're really into
San Antonio. And like you said, New York, I mean, NYU is an urban campus to the extreme.
Yes. It doesn't really happen. I mean,
yeah, like we lived on the same floor. We turned out, you know, we met each other at this class, but it turned out we lived on the same floor of our dorm. And the campus, you know, if you know New York geography, is like Broadway and 8th. Our dorm was 26th Street and 1st.
Yes.
You know, we lived on the 20th floor. So it's a, you know, bit of a culture shock.
We were kind of, it was difficult finding the dorm on the campus map.
It's not on.
Because it wasn't there.
No, and it's incredible to, you know, I went to school in Santa Barbara where the campus was this wide open spread out thing full of trees.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a dorm and then trees and another dorm and then, you know, other buildings. So the concept of going to NYU where you're in a high rise.
Yeah.
20th floor for a dorm room. Right now, it strikes me as the coolest thing of all time. But when I was 17, it was probably too intimidating to consider.
And then our first semester, Charlotte was on the elevator and the cable snapped and she fell 17 floors.
It sure did.
Oh, my God. You had that experience?
Yeah, it was. I was alone in the elevator. I was going to class and, you know, I was on my way to class. I got in on the 20th floor. Everything started shaking and the elevator started falling at 19. It stopped at 7 and I was like, you know, pressing the emergency brake, emergency call button, the whole thing. So it stopped and like, you know, all this all this dust fell on me from the ceiling, and then it went again between, so it started falling again. It's shaking and everything. The world was shaking around me, and it stopped between 3 and 4. And so I was in the elevator for like, I don't know, 45 minutes or something. The fire department had to be called. Jaws of life were used. Like, I was pulled out from in between the floors.
And you were alone.
It's alone.
Yeah, and she
alone.
Sat down and started doing homework.
I did.
Oh my God.
I did. You know, I was in shock. I think I was in shock, and I was like, "Well, I've got this time. I'm not going anywhere." And you know, you just don't think about. I mean, I was compartmentalizing my life at the time, and I just started doing my homework, and then I went to class. And it was, and like the, I remember the security guards were just looking at me like I was a lunatic.
This was like 2 weeks after 9/11 as well.
Yeah, it was two. And I was going to the same class. It was that Tuesday. So I was going to the same class that I went to on 9/11. And yeah, it was really nutty. I didn't realize kind of what had happened to me until I started telling people and like their faces started dropping. And I was like, oh, this was bad. this was bad. And so... Yeah, it was a lovely...
An eventful first semester.
Yeah, it was an eventful first semester. I met the man I was going to marry and my life partner and work partner. Yeah. Almost died.
And not to get too personal, because obviously I'm supposed to be more interested in you two as filmmakers than life partners. But was it instantaneous? I'm sure anyone would ask you, like, was there... When you sat together at the training session... Yeah. Of day one, were you already thinking I'm attracted to that person, or did that come like years later?
It came pretty quickly. That first day, I did not immediately look at Sean and say, "Yep, there he is." I did ask him if he knew how to use light meter, and he did not.
They gave us out. They handed out
right because you were the photographer.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So you were like, all this photography stuff is old hat to me.
It's a light meter. I was a photographer, you know, I was a high school photographer. I'd never seen a light meter
before.
Never
used professional equipment.
I never used professional equipment. You know, I had my little, my little SLR camera, but, so they pass out light meters to basically like, here's a light meter. This is how you
light.
And
they're trying to sell them.
And they're trying to sell them. And so, I looked to one side of me and I saw this like, you know, kind of muscular guy, blonde, kind of this like blonde Adonis sitting next to me. And I was like, well, he probably doesn't know how to use a light meter. Like I totally was very judgmental. And I turned to this like kind of smaller, obvious film nerd on the other side of me. And I was like, well, he knows. And so I asked him and he didn't know either. And that was Sean.
Yeah.
That is a very
one before.
I've never seen one before, and I was like, okay, great. But I think we still worked together on it, right?
We had to.
Yeah, we shared light meters, and then
I like Charlotte immediately. Is the answer there?
I was you know busy doing my work. You know, I was the elevator girl doing our work, and then we were in the same intro to film class, the same production class. And, you know, we just started working on each other's movies immediately in that first semester. And I mean, we were dating by November.
Yeah.
Early November.
By November.
Oh. Yeah. So we,
and that was the sophomore year for you both.
Yeah. It was
my junior year.
And my sophomore year. But we've been together ever since. I mean,
coming up on 17 years.
Yeah.
But while you were in film school, your projects were your own.
Yes.
Yes. And then our senior year, like, we wrote together and like I produced Charlotte's like senior film and she produced mine.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't until after college that like we got serious about writing together.
Yeah. Cause we, you know, we would write separately and then give the other one our work and it just really, you know, his, we just really meshed.
I think like I much preferred what Charlotte was writing and she preferred what I was writing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just made sense to work together.
Well, and you, so when you finished, and obviously you were it was the directing program there?
Just the undergrad is...
undergrad.
Yeah, is a degree in film and television production. So it's cool, like one semester, you know, you're shooting 16 millimeter black and white silent. And the next semester, you know, they've got a TV studio that you're learning how to do 3-camera cutting.
Right. And just to add, from my biased point of view, is you went through film school together, looking at each other's work, and you didn't lose respect for each other, which says something nice. Because I know a lot of times when you're in a program like that, you know, you meet people just as friends, and then you find out, oh, but they're not very good.
Yeah.
And, you know, we kind of looked at film school, you know, as, I mean, or I knew I wasn't very good. You know what I mean? I knew I wasn't there yet. So,
you were humble and you knew you had a lot to learn.
Yeah. And that's what we really looked at it as a learning experience.
As an opportunity to fail. To just like, you know, so every time we did something, it was always trying to be out of our comfort zone. Like, I don't know how to make this. You know, yeah. I don't know how to, you know, I know how to do this thing I did last semester, but I have no idea how I'm going to manage, you know, cast this big, you know.
Yeah.
What happened right after graduation? What did you stay in New York and you both started looking for film or TV related jobs?
Yeah. We stayed in New York for another year. We both worked for The Late Show with David Letterman, just in like the audience department. And like I worked at Starbucks from like 5:30 in the morning to 1 p.m. and then went to The Late Show at like 4 p.m. and you had a couple of like production assistant,
I had office production jobs that I was like an assistant, to producers and stuff. I was horrible at it. I mean, I was like the worst.
You're also a production manager on a feature.
I did. Yeah. I was a production manager on a feature and, I really liked being on set. I really liked doing it. I was still in, you know, figuring out that I wanted to direct and write, you know, even after undergrad, I was still kind of, you know, I was still mulling around like, do I actually want to direct or do I want to produce?
At the time.
Yeah.
It felt like NYU was pushing women into producing.
At the time. Yeah. At the time.
Like sort of in a gender bias way of like women produce and men create.
Yes.
Kind of like an unconscious.
Yeah, it was totally unconscious. But you know, so
I. Well, that's what sexism is. It's rarely.
Yes. Obviously, okay, so
it's rarely overt.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so I was still figuring out like, okay, I really want to be a director. You know, I really am a director. And that was, I had to kind of.
Could you try producing?
I tried producing. I produce other people's stuff, outside of Sean. I produced other people's shorts and stuff at NYU, and I was good at it. I'm a good manager, you know. But I just realized I really wanted to create my own stuff, and that took a little bit. And so we moved to LA, and I did. I was a dog walker in LA. Like Sean worked at a marketing company.
Yeah, I worked at a company that made movie trailers, and we basically just tried to get jobs that allowed us to write together, so we could spend time during the day writing. Because we had friends who did a lot of like PA work and, you know, good jobs, but
they were exhausted
and didn't have time to do what they wanted to do.
To develop their voice.
Right. And the trailer job meant like working the nights or?
No. I started out as like a runner, just delivering tapes. You know, they still use, you know, DVDs or 3/4-inch tapes to different studios. But then I moved into the tape room, which is where you make copies of all the trailers. And, it's a lot of machinery and it's behind a locked door. So people thought it was like super complicated and I didn't dispel them of that notion. And I didn't have that much work to do, but people just assume you're slammed because you just have an entire wall filled with these 3/4-inch tape, you know, decks.
But you just hit one button and then you
just hit one button and you have nothing to do.
And so what would you do?
And so I did a lot of reading and we would write, you know, we would be on the phone while you were walking executives' dogs.
Yeah.
You know, just talking about story and figuring out
and also like watching like Bergman movies.
Yeah. I had a monitor. I'd watch a lot of Criterion movies. And like, I remember
the library
was down the street, the Ivar library. I remember watching, The Wild Strawberries, and the boss came in and it's really hard to pretend you just have a movie on in the background when it's like a really intense foreign film.
There's subtitles.
Yeah.
Understood. But so you came to LA together and you did the classic entry-level Hollywood-type jobs.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when did you make something again?
No, we just wrote. And
you just wrote.
We just wrote.
And at the time we were just telling ourselves that, like, well, paper's freak. You know, it's
pretty low budget.
Yeah. It doesn't cost anything to write. Just trying to develop, like, well, what kind of movies, what kind of stories do we want to tell?
And then the housing market crashed and,
we were in LA for about 4 years and got really sick of it.
Yeah.
Started to get just kind of burned out. And, we spent, a couple of weeks in Colorado and had a great time. And then, we ended up cutting our trip short because we did really well in a screenplay competition. We were finalists, at the Script Pipeline screenplay competition, had to go back to LA for that. And we had like a, When we started leaving, going back home, we had a pit in our stomach, and we're like, well, that's not how you should ever feel about home. And so driving from Colorado to LA, you have to pass through Vegas, and like Charlotte just said, the housing market had crashed. And so we stopped and stayed like 2 nights in Vegas and looked at foreclosures and found a house we loved.
Yeah.
And that we could afford, and for the price of like a bathroom in LA.
After the crash, Vegas is one of the cheapest places in the country.
It was hit the hardest. Like Vegas and Orlando were hit the hardest, and so we were like, well, this seems crazy, but we'll put in an offer, and if we get this place, we'll move. If not, well, we're in LA, and it ended up working. And
then our first feature was about foreclosure.
Oh, really?
So, there you go. That's kind of, and then we, we wrote our feature, Virgin Alexander,
in Vegas,
and, and then it just really came together very quickly.
Yeah, it was weird. Once we moved to Vegas, like, anytime we would, at first we were like, oh my God, we're living so far from LA. Can we do this? This is crazy. And then our first trip back to LA, like, we had a meeting or something in, like, downtown LA, and we're staying in the Valley, and it took us, like, there was like an accident on the 101 or something, and it took us like 2 hours to drive 12 miles. And it's like, well, I'd rather drive for 4 hours and go 200 miles, 250 miles than do this. So it was funny. Once we didn't live in LA, when we came to LA, we could get meetings because it's like, oh, they're only in town for a few days.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was really bizarre that like, then people were more interested in our work. And, we finished our script of Virgin Alexander, and, like, we met a couple of producers from the screen that, found out about us because of the screenplay competition. Yeah. And
was it Virgin Alexander that did well at Pipeline? No?
It was another
script we had. Because at the time we were writing Virgin Alexander, and then we finished Virgin Alexander, and a producer out of Austin read it and
was like, hey, we can do this.
I think we can do this pretty cheap. And we're like, okay, sure. And 6 months later, we were shooting.
Wow.
It was really.
I meant to ask, when you were writing the whole time in LA before you went to Vegas and started Virgin Alexander, were you writing like studio pictures? Was your goal, to write the next T2 or something like that?
No,
you were doing like small, charming scripts.
Yeah, they were.
Because spoiler alert, like I've seen Virgin Alexander.
And
it's so charming, it's just a sweet, charming indie film. So I would have been surprised if you had been trying to write big budget action things, but who knows?
They're still like,
it's quirky. It's always like, a little off. It was always kind of like, we're gonna explore this genre. I mean, kind of like what we did with VA. We're gonna explore this genre, but we're gonna do it in a weird way. I don't know.
That might be unsatisfying. because Virgin Alexander, like on the surface, it's about a guy whose home's going into foreclosure, so he turns into a brothel, and that's high concept. That's a sex comedy idea,
totally could have been National Lampoon's.
The way we handle it and the way were interested in that story isn't, you know, for us, that was a movie about loneliness. That was a guy feeling trapped by his environment. And, you know, Alexander's a piano player, but he has no way to express his art.
He's silent.
He doesn't really talk much, you know. So just...
He's terrified of women.
And we explore how men are threatened by women and how scared they are of women. And those aren't things you're going to find in, like, a Hollywood sex comedy. So
nobody wants to talk about that.
So it's interesting that we actually, like, when we started screening Virgin Alexander, we thought, like, oh, man, like... You know, young guys are going to like us. And no, they didn't. Some of them got really mad about the movie.
We had college students in tears coming up to us after.
But then our biggest fans were older women.
Yeah.
Like women in their 50s just loved the movie, which was crazy.
Yeah.
It like seemed crazy to me.
Interesting, because you don't even have a female character out of her 20s, right?
No. I don't think so.
You got a couple of older men.
There's a mom character, but it's
definitely a young person movie. It's about people in their 20s. You know, it's a young...
Made by young people.
Made by young people. You know, we have a few older characters, but it's a young person.
But at, like, Film Festival, you find, like, there'd be older women, like, or women in their 50s, like... Who would come the next night as well? Who would see it twice?
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was totally. I mean, you know, it's a fool's errand to like try to guess your audience at this point. You know,
no,
like,
especially when you're so young and you're still, you know, figuring out your voice.
You know, your female characters in there are, well, they're selling their bodies, but you give them other motivations. You know, including one who is just doing it for research for her.
Yeah.
Doctorate.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I'm actually very surprised that women in their 50s were like super cool with the young women selling their bodies. Although I guess it's not bad. And you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's whether or not we don't treat our characters as victims. Kind of their.
They had agency over.
They had agency over.
Very much so, yeah.
Their life and.
And it is about how, like, you know, these guys do think like this is going to be so awesome, but they're terrified. Like in actuality, they're actually terrified of women and incredibly insecure
and terrified of women's power over them.
Very much, and the women are very strong. The women are the strong characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, kind of about that negotiation of life with, you know, wanting something from someone and you don't know how to get it.
And it's making you angry.
Totally. Well, and actually thinking about it, I can see why young guys might have been mad because the way the bachelor party goes and whatnot.
It
should be funny to them, but I guess they,
It wasn't. It was funny to us.
We made our audience work very hard for that movie.
Yeah. It's not a movie that, comes to you. You really have to come to it. Because, I mean, like, in the way we shot it, too, it was very, like, a lot of oners, like, just long takes.
A lot of silence.
You know, we had our lead actor watch a lot of Buster Keaton beforehand, just for the stillness. Yeah,
it was a hard movie.
It's a hard movie. Yeah,
yeah, it's a weird, hard little movie. And
it was playing the festivals, and you said 2011?
2012.
Yeah, because, you know, seeing it in 2018. I have a totally different impression of it, which is, you know, that most of it was sort of the sweet, charming thing. By the way, I really noticed how the music was really good. The music always fit the mood, and that your lead actor was kind of a superstar with the singing and the piano and then the dancing at the end. My God, like
incredible. Yeah.
He's incredible.
He's a Broadway actor. We saw him. He was Frankie Valli in Jersey Boys and he had done the Broadway show, but he would, as a different character, but in Vegas, he was he originated the Frankie Valli role. And, you know, like at like a mall, we got like a for a mall promotion in Vegas, we got free tickets to Jersey Boys. And so we went to see it, and it was while we were in pre-production. And his opening, he comes like kind of skipping across the stage as like 14-year-old Frankie Valli. And the moment he came out, we both said out loud at the same time, that's Alexander.
Yeah.
Well, I saw that show in Vegas.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, you probably saw Rick.
Him. You totally saw him. And at one point in the show, you know, they go on American Bandstand or whatever, and cameras are wheeled out, and you see a big close-up.
Like a jumbotron of when they sing Sherry. Like, that was like our screen test. We're like, oh, my God.
Oh, this fantastic is on camera. Like, oh, this guy's incredible. And so amazingly, you know, I mean, he's the lead, you know, and we need him for a month. So incredibly, Jersey Boys flew in a replacement for him to go do this indie movie. And it was just such a gift.
Really? So they gave him a month off?
Yes.
Yeah.
For us to make
it was,
for
but I mean, it was
movie.
Touch and go for a while. We didn't find out he could do it till 7 days before we started shooting. And
yeah.
Like, that was, it was like, he's the guy. He's it. Like, we're starting shooting on June 21st with this guy.
With this guy. And we'll see. And it happened. He was just like, I mean, what a gift he is.
And he didn't know how to play piano. He, our composer was on set because we wanted the piano playing to be like that he does at his home in the brothel to be on set, to be live. And so he learned it every night after shooting. He would practice playing piano. So all the piano was recorded live. It was really awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, I think that showed too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because live recorded music is so much better than.
Oh,
yeah. Fake, it was right? Like, because I mean, like, the music he plays ends up being incorporated in the score. It's the theme song. And so it was, like, really incredible, like, for the cast to have, like, to know the theme of the movie, like, as
on
they.
Set.
Yeah, on set.
On set. And it was so much fun with VA, too. I mean, it was film camp because, like, you know, we had this huge cast of people from L.A., from New York.
And that was shot in Vegas?
No, it was shot in upstate New York.
Okay, that makes more sense because I'm like, what part of Vegas could you find that would look like that?
We essentially moved to upstate New York for a few months.
Yeah, I grew up in Saratoga Springs, and it's a big horse racing town in the summer, and so Seabiscuit shot there, The Horse Whisperer, Billy Baffy, like all these horse themed movies. And they really wanted to expand beyond that. And so they got rid of their film permit requirements. And so we never needed a film permit. Like, we could shoot anywhere. We could close down streets. We didn't need a cop on set. They were just so incredibly film friendly. And we were able to do these things that a movie, you know, $100,000 movie should not be allowed to do.
Right. And that actually shows because there's so many different, I was going to use the word sets, but yeah, there's so many different locations.
Yeah. It was funny. Like, there's a big college in Saratoga, Skidmore, and Skidmore just ended and the track season hadn't begun. So there were all these rental units that either the college kids or the tourists rent. And there was like a 6 week period where they were empty, so we got to use them for our 3 week shoot.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah,
and Sean's family was there, and
they were very
and
helpful. Some, yeah.
You know, his mom did the catering. Like, we were gonna.
Yeah, I think I saw the name Fallon a few times in the credits.
Yeah, it's in there.
It's definitely in there, and we were gonna farm out the catering, but it was just so expensive, and so Sean's mom like cooked, and
her and her best friend took over. And
it's hard to complain about the food when the director's mom is doing it. So
so she actually cooked on The Phantom Menace as
she
well.
She did.
Wow.
Yeah, so she flew out to L.A. and, like, just made it happen for The Phantom Menace. It was incredible.
Well, so now let me ask. So you do the festival circuit in 2012 with Virgin Alexander.
Yep.
And then I meet you in June of 2018 at Film Invasion L.A. with The Phantom Menace. So what was in between those two?
A lot of life. A lot of pain. Life, you know, life kind of, you know, we wrote a lot, you know, we wrote for producers.
Yeah, we got jobs like off. It was funny you said National Lampoon's because they contacted us and we wrote a script for them.
I'm based in Vegas.
Based in Vegas, but would go into, like, and we were going to L.A. a lot.
Yeah.
So we actually had a small apartment in Silver Lake for, like, 2 years. or a couple of years. Yeah. You know, that we had to, you know, for meetings and whatnot.
We tried to get, you know, our second feature together. It hasn't materialized. We've written several features. You know, it's just, you know, life, man.
and then we wanted
to make a short, but we just weren't having short ideas. We were having feature ideas. We were writing the feature ideas. And then finally, like, Sean had this great short idea. And we're like, hey, you know, we're trying to get this other feature made with a producer. And it hasn't been getting traction right now. So let's make a short with that producer. And so we talked to
That's the Phantom Menace.
We talked to...
But at the same time, we were having multiple miscarriages.
Yes, yes. And that's what I mean by the pain. You know,
right. So there was some personal pain.
Yeah.
Pain. Trying to start a family.
Yes.
And Sean's the one who said, let's turn that into a little bit of art.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you hadn't written a script. You just said, let's do it.
Well, I had had an idea. I had gone to a convention. I went to the Star Wars convention in Anaheim. When they debuted, like, before The Force Awakens came out, and they debuted the trailer with Harrison Ford as Han Solo. And I'd never been to, like, a comic convention or anything like that. And it was a lot of fun, and I just thought, like, this is a great environment. And, like, oh my god, I want to see a movie set here, but I think, like, the only times I've seen it, it kind of feels like it's making fun of the environment, making fun of people dressing up, and I was just like, no, I like, there should be like a walking and talking movie here, like a certified copy or Before Sunset, you know, sunrise movie, like, going on. And, but then I was like, well, you know, I wrote like a really bad version of that was just about, like, I had no connection to, and I was like, well, it's about a guy and a girl, and they're dressed as Star Wars characters.
And at some point, the girl kills the guy.
The girl's gonna kill the guy with a lightsaber, because he's annoying, and, you know, it's a fantasy sequence, and, you know, I just... And then, like, I remember one day walking our dog, and it was like, all of a sudden it hit me, I was like, oh, we've been having... You know, we've had three miscarriages at this point.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it should be about miscarriage. Like, they just had a miscarriage, and they still...
Right, and three miscarriages is 2+ years of your life.
No, it was, like 4.
4 years.
Yeah, it was, like, 4. Right. I think, all told, it was, like, 5 years until we had a baby. But, yeah.
Right, so you made that decision to start a family, and then 5 years of difficulty.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or more accurately, pain, as you called it.
Right.
So Sean had the idea, and then you finally realized to make your Star Wars convention movie. You realized you wanted to add something very, very deep and human to it.
Yeah.
Because our work had always, like, skirted around being personal, but never quite being able to, or not knowing.
It was unconsciously
personal, which, I mean, you can't really avoid, but, like, not knowing, like, how to actually express yourself and filter your experience through our work. I didn't, you know, it hadn't made sense until that point.
And then
we were able to, you know, write that. And because, like, I mean, I remember the first miscarriage, kind of similar to the movie, you know, we were traveling. We were in New York City. It was, like, your birthday trip.
Yeah.
You know, we were there for your birthday and a couple of, like, work meetings.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we didn't know what to do. We're like, well, should we go home and be sad, or...
Yeah, you were supposed to be having a good time in New York, and then tragedy struck.
Yeah, and we have... we have work.
But also we have these tickets. Like, we have Broadway tickets. We were going to see a show the next day. And you know, Jim in The Phantom Menace says, like, to his wife, like, well, we already have the tickets. And, like, that's what I said. You know? Like, you're just like, well, and, he, like, Lily in the movie says, like, I'll be sad at home.
That's what I said.
You know, that's what Charlotte said.
What's the point? What's the point of not doing what we're supposed to be doing? And there's apparently a big
maybe this will be fun, and, like, you know, the idea that you can escape your grief.
Yeah.
Well, and at what point did it switch from an idea Sean had to a script you were both working on together?
there's no difference. I mean, there's no, like, there's...
It just happens.
He comes... I mean, what...
You're like the early years of Lennon McCartney, where whoever started it brings it into the partnership, and it just becomes...
Yeah, there's never any, like...
There's no...
claims of ownership or, you know, just...
Yeah, it's...
If, you know, if someone can be like, no, I don't know about that, but...
Right, if you both agree you want to work on it, it just happens.
Yeah, it's our work. It's not... You know, it's our idea.
Because you were interested in the convention idea as well, but it just, we hadn't figured out an angle. And then I just happened to be the one that was like, oh, what if it's about this? And then we both started working on it.
There's no, like,
And I mean, was it part of a healing process to work on that script?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. It was incredibly healing. I mean, so much so that our baby was born 9 months after we shot.
Right, so you didn't even know you'd succeeded yet.
No.
Yeah, and then, you know, so you were pregnant.
Wait, now, I'm sorry, I'm so slow, the math. 9 months after you shot, so you conceived during production?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, right afterwards, something, you know, somewhere around there. Like, I mean, I mean, we had to make the movie. You know, we had to make that movie to have a baby. I mean, that's the truth.
That's actually very special. My goodness.
It's absolutely, I mean, incredible how powerful art and healing is.
You know, I believe it. I believe it. I mean, as I told you, I think via email when I first saw your film, you know, my generation, I mean, I'm older than you guys, but I think my generation was one of the first to like really start waiting to start families and the number of miscarriages in my group of friends, you know, it's remarkably high.
And it's, you know, it's always been high. I mean, even if you're 22, you know, like it, you know, yes, when you're older, maybe the number, I really don't know, but like, miscarriages are so common. I mean, it is so common and not discussed.
Yeah, and so painful, and then people have no way to deal with that pain.
Yeah, men and women. You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of focus on women, you know, in their pain. I mean, some focus, you know what I mean? But it really... I mean, for men, I mean, what do they do with it?
No, that's one of the things I love so much about The Phantom Menace is that it really is each member of that couple is walking their own path.
Yeah.
And they're grieving in their own way.
And getting in touch with their grief. And also, I mean, you know, her anger. You know, I mean, she doesn't feel heard, you know?
Well, and it's not until they acknowledge each other's grief as well, and acknowledge their own grief, and by acknowledging their own grief, they can acknowledge the other person's grief.
Yeah.
And that allows them to heal. And that was definitely our experience.
Oh, yes.
And it's a comedy.
Yeah, and it's a comedy. And it's real funny.
No, it's really funny. I still, no matter how many times I see it, every time you're Indiana Jones, Darth Maul speaks. I think it's the funniest. I don't know. I think that's one of the funniest, smartest moments I've ever seen. Really.
Thank you very much. I mean, it was a really interesting movie to make.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because for me also, it's funny. I was thinking about the film and I was thinking how it really is just a series of revelations. And like, first you're revealing stuff to the audience.
Yes.
And then things are being revealed to the characters as they're going through that day. And the fact that that's the first time she uses the word, right? Isn't that the first time she says, like, she just says, I had a miscarriage.
That's the first time she uses it.
He kept saying it, but she was fighting it.
Yes.
And then she finally admits it to this stranger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the stranger says, is that your backstory?
Yeah.
That's the funniest thing I've ever seen. And it's a surprise female who like is giving her no empathy whatsoever.
Yeah.
That's such smart writing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Or I could go through that scene by scene and tell you like that it's one of my favorite films.
Thank you. Yeah, it was so cool to make a you know, like such a deep, like the juxtaposition of like making such like a deeply personal, serious subject matter, but doing it, you know, at a convention, at a live convention, was just wild. It almost helped that it was at this like absurd location, you know, that we didn't have control over. So, you know, we had permission to shoot there, but we were trying to do these, you know, we did do these very, you know, dramatic scenes,
intimate scenes,
personal scenes, you know, scenes ripped from our lives, you know,
with actors dressed in cosplay.
Yeah, dressed as Princess Leia, Star Wars, you know, Jedi Knight from the prequels.
Yeah, for the actors, I mean, they obviously knew this was pulled from your lives.
Yeah. We had talked to them about that.
So did that sort of give them a sort of a deeper connection with you as the creators?
It's definitely something to ask them.
I would think so. Yeah, I'm asking the wrong person.
But
because if you read the script, I mean, you know, it is absurd, but it's very grounded, it's weighted, and so I think it just let them know that, like, we're taking this very seriously. You know, this is, yes, it's a comedy. Yes, you're right. These are, you know, these are funny moments. We're never making fun of any of this.
But we're taking this pain.
Yes.
This humanity very seriously.
So I think it allowed them to trust us.
Yes, I think it did too.
Correct.
And, I mean, on a side note, you're taking, like you said, you're not making fun of the fandom of it. You're not making fun of the genre or the love of Star Wars or Star Trek. Because I know a lot of people try to make fun of what's called nerd culture now, but it is. It's just American. It's our culture.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's a sports team. Like, do you like sports? Do you like movies? Do you like, you know, at the end, you know, their reconciliation, they're next to an American flag. And it's like, are you patriotic? Like, it's just, what do you believe in? What fills you up? What makes you feel good?
And what connects you? What makes you feel connected to the world?
Yeah, so when you were working on this, so I didn't actually, I think I failed to ask you, like, how you, when you came up with this short idea, and then you were working with someone about a feature, and then said, how about we do this short?
Yeah. We sent our producer, Bettina Barrow, the short. We're like, hey, what do you think of this? And she loved it and was like, oh, wow, we should make this.
Yeah, we should make this. And maybe Lily Ray will make it with us.
Yeah, because Bettina is partners with Lily. They have a production company together.
And Bettina knew Eric Layden, who was our other lead.
I got to tell you, they're so good.
I know. They're incredible. And she really, I mean, she, you know, she got us that cast, you know, she got them the script and they're amazing in it.
Yeah.
They're absolutely amazing. And it, and she, you know, did a great job producing, and cause it was a big production. I mean, we had a lot of crew. It was a live location. We had no time. Like, it was a lot.
Yeah, we only had, we had Eric both days, but Lily's schedule, she was, like, shooting a movie right before and then immediately after. So we had her for one day, and we had to do, you know,
8 pages.
Like, yeah, over eight pages in that one day. And that was intense.
And we did.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know. 12 hours, you know, it was down to 12 hours.
Yeah, it was down to the wire to get the, you know, and because the location's closing. So it's not like, well, everyone can just work late.
Yeah, know? No, you can't ask for overtime from all the members of the public who happen to be there.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, like, they're going to turn the lights off.
Yeah.
You know? Hey, we have to go. So, but we finished with more than enough time for everyone to close up shop.
Yeah, but going back, so it was a very special script. Very special screenplay, and people who saw it responded to it that way.
Yes.
And so it sounds like it was a very, just a positive production experience.
It was.
It really was. Yeah, it was wonderful. Because, I mean, and also, you know, we have the scene where, you know, Eric goes to get an autograph because a major part of these conventions are the celebrity guests, and you can get, you know, your favorite actor's autograph. So we had written Robert Picardo, who was in Star Trek Voyager. I mean, just a great actor who was in Hail Caesar and Gremlins 2 and The Wonder Years. And
just a great character.
You know, but we, you know, we wrote him as himself, like, you know, so we sent the script to his agent and, like, you know, but the script says Robert Picardo is playing Robert Picardo. And,
yeah.
And that was something he had never done before and was...
Never wanted to do,
but he, you know, at first he just said, like, no, I'm not, this is not, I don't want to, no, I'm not interested. But his agent was like, well, read the script. I think you might like it. And he did. He really responded to the script, loved the script. And
he was probably in and out in, what, an hour or two?
2 hours.
For 2 hours. That was
I mean, that's not a huge ask in the L.A. area.
He actually had to fly.
We had to take him straight. He had a flight that day, so we had to actually take him from, I mean, because we shot in the City of Industry at Frank & Sons, and so we had to take him directly to the airport.
Yeah, it was, and, you know, it's a lot to ask of an actor to play himself.
Yeah.
And, in a short film.
Although he was a fictional character written by you, he
right.
wasn't necessarily himself playing himself, right? He was playing your version of him.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yes, of course. But he was playing, yes, he was playing the comic convention version of him, I guess.
Yeah.
But
how cool is that? That the person you wrote, you got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was amazing.
And I think I told you at the festival, at the Q&A at the festival, that like one of the board members who's a big Star Trek fan, he was like, I want you to ask them why they went with a Star Trek performer when all the other characters are Star Wars.
That was part of my healing process, because it was Charlotte's idea, and I was at first just like, no, absolutely not. This is not Star, because I've enjoyed some of the Star Trek movies, but like, I gravitate towards Star Wars. I was like, this is about Star Wars. This is about me.
What's the difference?
Yeah, what's the difference?
I can't picture you talking like that, but go on.
That's how it felt. In hindsight, that's how it felt.
But it's just, what's the difference? And
usually, like, I think I'm good at recognizing whenever I, like, disagree with something so strongly, that's probably what I should do. There's probably
a
reason.
That would be beneficial.
That would be beneficial.
But it was Charlotte saying, let's do Picardo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're a Star Trek? He's your favorite, or?
No.
No, you're not a Star Trek fan.
No.
Just like,
no.
Actor,
he's a great actor. He's lovely.
You wanted to open up the world to Star Trek, and like, because like we were talking about earlier, what's the difference? It's, you know, they're you know, it's...
It's such an interesting choice, because... Wow, that's just so interesting it's such a huge universe. Once you add Star Trek, there could have been so many actors to approach.
Yeah, that's true. It's
and you approach the one who said yes?
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. And he plays the Doctor.
Yeah.
And they're dealing with miscarriage, and he's talking.
That's interesting.
I never thought about that. Eric's talking to him about the surgery his wife just had.
Oh, God, I didn't think of that.
No, it's... Funny.
It just worked out.
Yeah.
It works perfect. And it really is such a great moment when they're sitting there under the flag and he says, I got you Robert Picardo's. And she's just like, as she reaches for it, she's like, oh, I love him.
Yeah.
Like that's such a sweet moment for me, because it was the husband knowing what she would love. And, you know, she had that moment.
It's what he could do. And in that moment.
Yeah. Know? And it shows that he does know her, and he's not a guy who deserves a lightsaber in his gut.
Yeah, he's thinking about her. He wants to make it better. He doesn't know how to make it better, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't know yet that he can't. All he can...
Yeah.
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 This isn't something you fix. This is something you accept together or deal with together.
Yeah, and then grow together.
And then kudos to your relationship, because you conceived then and there.
It worked.
Charlotte edited while nauseous.
Totally nauseous and exhausted and baking a baby. it was very healing. I mean, apparently we were supposed to go through this. And it's interesting, conceiving, everybody talks about your movie being your baby, you know, like, it's just a weird, you know, it's a creation. Our son is our, you know, we created him.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, did getting pregnant at that time also sort of give you a perspective of, like, this short film is not the most important thing in life anymore? Or there's there's another life on the way?
Well, the whole kind of last, you know, basically since Virgin Alexander, because that, you know, it was a $100,000 feature that we wrote, directed, edited, and, you know, took on the road and got distribution for it. Like, that just,
it was all consuming,
you know, that was like an all-consuming 2 to 3 years of our lives, and then realizing that, like, oh, you know, whereas Phantom Menace and the work we, you know, we just made another short film, has not been all-consuming, but it's felt like we've had a deeper connection to our work and realizing, like, oh, we can't separate our lives from our work. Like, they all feed each other.
And they can't consume the other.
One can't consume the other, yeah.
No, really can't now. You don't even have that option.
I mean, there's always options.
I guess, yeah, you could be super neglectful parents.
You know,
yeah,
no, it, there
it,
is.
It I mean, happens.
Like, yeah.
Oh, no, it's, I recommend it.
But it's, it, you know, there's always choices. Yeah, totally. And it's true. You know, we had to, you know, I had a lot of shoulds in my life. I've been editing them out.
it's interesting you say that because you sound to me like the firebrand who left home to go to New York and then left New York for LA and then left, you know, a lot of people would have felt like they can't leave LA and you guys did.
Yeah.
So yeah. You actually sound really bold to me.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, we're just navigating, you know, navigating this thing called life.
So you've almost wrapped up your festival run for The Phantom Menace.
Yes.
Or are you wrapped up, or is there like one more you said?
Yeah, we're screening this month in the Adirondack Film, or in October at the Adirondack Film Festival and the Orlando Film Festival. And we were just asked by a festival in North Carolina, so we might do that.
We don't know.
We might have a couple more, but I don't know.
It's unclear at this point.
Yeah, and we're not, you know, like Virgin Alexander, I mean, we were hammering the festival circuit, and like,
we,
you know.
We went to a lot of
fests. And had success, like,
learned a lot.
Yeah, it was a good opportunity, like, learning to talk in front of the movie, but we're kind of just trying to be, or, like, learning to be present. And
yeah.
Just whatever happens, happens, and it feels much better that way.
When are you at nearly, like, a full year on the circuit?
Yes. Yeah, I guess it is now a year.
Yeah, it is now a year. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, though, most festivals aren't going to get something of this quality very often. So I'm not surprised that you keep getting more and more festivals to go to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're looking for, you know, we had some distribution offers, but we're a little leery just because of all the Star Wars stuff. And even though, like, we've been told, like, it's fair use, it works fine. When it is released on the internet, we'll probably have to change its name.
Probably.
Yeah. You said that the Q&A and boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We thought so. We thought it fit our movie better than it fits episode one.
Of course it does. Episode one is just the film that shouldn't even exist, but.
But hey, it's given Sean a lot of joy, you know, like you loved it when you were a kid.
Well, the struggle between like, this is bad, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. You know?
Oh, so what you're saying, you enjoyed Phantom Menace in the theaters?
When I saw it when I was 17, I had no... This is what I love about seeing a new... I'm a big Star Wars fan. This is what I love about seeing a new Star Wars movie. It'll take me at least 10 years to know how I actually feel about it. So I know the night I go, I'm going to have a great time. And, you know, I won't know where the chips fall for at least a decade.
Yeah.
That's good. That's very healthy.
Processing time.
Excellent. So wrapping this up, the Phantom Menace up on the festival circuit and then eventually releasing. So do you have a pile of scripts you're thinking about next, or?
Yeah, we have, we've already shot another short that we're in post on now that was our first time shooting in Vegas. And that was really fun to shoot close to home, shoot at home. And so we're in post on that. And then we have another feature that takes place in Vegas that we're starting to put together.
Yeah. It's a, yeah.
Smaller, like, romantic comedy in Vegas.
Yeah.
Right, but you are in Vegas, which is production value, free production value all over the place.
Yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. Yeah. Without a doubt. It's a great place to shoot. The crews are great, and works, and it's a lovely location.
Yeah, I mean, that's super smart. Just the same way you use that convention as just a super identifiable background.
Yeah.
You are in probably the I would say it's New York, then Vegas, for identifiable cities in America.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, yeah. And Vegas has so many different, like, different types of architecture, which is cool to, you know, it's got the Strip, but downtown, and it's a funky city.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
That I don't think has been necessarily exploited well in movies.
No, because movies always just stay on the Strip, if yeah. that. And then they make up imaginary vaults underground.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
They'll do the rest of the shooting in Burbank.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Strip shots.
So it feels like a movie.
Yeah.
You know, so it feels like a movie.
Well, that's cool. You know, it's funny. I didn't even know you were Vegas-based. For some reason, I thought you were up north. I don't know how but I knew you came from out of town, at least.
Yes. Right.
But you guys were lovely to do that.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
yeah,
we had a great time.
It was great. And some of our LA friends got to see on the big screen, which was really, really nice. And we got to reconnect with them. And it was fun.
And there you have it. Charlotte Barrett and Sean Fallon, the married filmmaking team who do everything. They write, they direct, sounds like they edit. They do it all as a partnership, and it comes out great. I want to thank them for taking the time to talk to me and for making such a great film. Again, you can go to discoverindiefilm.com and see A Bad Feeling right now. It'll be embedded right there. And I really hope you do, because if you like film at all, A Bad Feeling is really one of the better films you're going to get to see. But enough of me going on about how great it is. I've got to wrap this up. Discover Indie Film. Catch the podcast anywhere you get podcasts, or they're all at discoverindiefilm.com. If you want to watch the Discover Indie Film TV series, just go to Amazon Prime Video and search for Discover Indie Film. And when you watch and like it, the next thing you do should be to give it a great review on Amazon, right? Because you want to help. And I also got to mention that every June is Film Invasion Los Angeles, and every November is the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. And I don't think I have to mention anything else. All right. Thanks again to Charlotte and Sean, and thank you all for listening.